There's a company called Oxitec. It's owned by Bill Gates now. And the way his GMO mosquito control works is the genetically engineered male mosquito carries a gene that passes to their offspring and kills female progeny in early larval stages. Male offspring won't die, but instead will become carriers of the gene and pass it to future generations. As more females die, the Aedes aegypti population should dwindle. And that is the way their mosquito control program works in Oxitec. This is the one that is talking about releasing it in the Florida Keys and Texas. And basically, they're trying to kill off a whole species of mosquitoes. And not only is that irresponsible, because you should not make any species go extinct, I cannot believe the EPA has approved this type of treatment for transmission of dengue and Zika. And I mean, I cannot believe that, because I mean, that should go against every environmental protection agency rule. You cannot be killing species off. I feel like that's wrong. What do you guys think? Do you agree with this process of treating mosquitoes? Or do you agree with just putting the Wolbachia into the mosquitoes? Which I don't understand why they're not just putting the Wolbachia into the mosquitoes in order to prevent dengue from growing inside the mosquito. Which is something we talked about in an earlier podcast. But for some reason, Oxitec wants to kill the Aedes aegypti mosquito species completely. And the government, the US government, approved these killer mosquitoes to fight the disease. I mean, these mosquitoes are like on a dying mission, basically. There's not going to be any more females created, and so eventually that species dies. And they're spending billions upon billions and billions and millions and billions of dollars to make these mosquitoes. They are going to be getting charged an arm and a leg. And mosquitoes are a good thing. You know, they help build the immune system. And it's crazy that nobody talks about how mosquitoes can be a benefit, and we're just talking about killing them. So it's very disturbing.
California is a company that sells genetic engineering kits. The company's founder, Josiah Zahner, sports a side-swept undercut, multiple piercings, and a tattoo that urges, "Create something beautiful." He holds a PhD in biophysics and is a well-known provocateur. Among his many stunts, he has coaxed his skin to produce a fluorescent protein, ingested a friend's poop in a DIY fecal matter transplant, and attempted to deactivate one of his genes so that he could grow bigger muscles. This last effort, he acknowledges, failed. Zahner calls himself a genetic designer and has said that his goal is to give people access to the resources they need to modify life in their spare time. The Odin's offerings range from a biohack the planet shot glass, which costs $3, to a genetic engineering home lab kit, which runs almost $2,000 and includes a centrifuge, a polymerase chain reaction machine, and an electrophoresis gel box. I opted for something in between, the bacterial CRISPR and fluorescent yeast combo kit, which set me back $209. It came in a cardboard box decorated with the company's logo, a twisting tree circled by a double helix. The tree, I believe, is supposed to represent Yggdrasil, whose trunk, in Norse mythology, rises through the center of the cosmos. Inside the box, I found an assortment of lab tools, pipette tips, petri dishes, disposable gloves, as well as several vials containing E. coli and all I'd need to rearrange its genome. The E. coli went into the fridge next to the butter. The other vials went into a bin in the freezer with the ice cream.
Gross.
Genetic engineering is, by now, middle-aged. The first genetically engineered bacterium was produced in 1973. This was soon followed by a genetically engineered mouse in 1974 and a genetically engineered tobacco plant in 1983. The first genetically engineered food approved for human consumption, the Flavor Saver tomato, was introduced in 1994. It proved such a disappointment that it went out of production a few years later. Genetically engineered varieties of corn and soy were developed around the same time. These, by contrast, have become more or less ubiquitous. In the past decade or so, genetic engineering has undergone its own transformation, thanks to CRISPR, shorthand for a suite of techniques mostly borrowed from bacteria that make it vastly easier for biohackers and researchers to manipulate DNA. The acronym stands for Clustered Regularly Interspaced Short Palindromic Repeats. CRISPR allows its users to snip a stretch of DNA and then either disable the affected sequence or replace it with a new one. The possibilities that follow are pretty much endless. Jennifer Doudna, a professor at the University of California, Berkeley, and one of the developers of CRISPR, has put it like this. We now have a way to rewrite the very molecules of life any way we wish. With CRISPR, biologists have already created, among many, many other living things, ants that can't smell, beagles that put on superhero-like brawn, pigs that resist swine fever, macaques that suffer from sleep disorders, coffee beans that contain no caffeine, salmon that don't lay eggs, mice that don't get fat, and bacteria whose genes contain, in code, Edward Muybridge's famous series of photographs showing a horse in motion. 2 years ago, a Chinese scientist, Ha Zhongkui, announced that he had produced the world's first CRISPR-edited humans, twin baby girls. According to Ha, the girls' genes had been tweaked to confer resistance to HIV, though whether this is actually the case remains unclear. Following his announcement, Ha was fired from his academic post in Shenzhen and sentenced to 3 years in prison. I have almost no experience in genetics and have not done hands-on lab work since high school. Still, by following the instructions that came in the box from Odin, in the course of a weekend, I was able to create a novel organism. First, I grew a colony of E. coli in one of the petri dishes. Then I doused it with the various proteins and bits of designer DNA I'd stored in the freezer. The process swapped out one letter of the bacteria's genome, replacing an A, adenine, with a C, cytosine. Thanks to this emendation, my new and improved E. coli could, in effect, thumb its nose at streptomycin, a powerful antibiotic. Although it felt a little creepy engineering a drug-resistant strain of E. coli in my kitchen, there was also a definite sense of achievement. So much so that I decided to move on to the second project in the kit, inserting a jellyfish gene into yeast in order to make it glow. The Australian Centre for Disease Preparedness in the city of Geelong is one of the most advanced high-containment laboratories in the world. It sits behind two sets of gates, the second of which is intended to foil truck bombers, and its poured concrete walls are thick enough, I was told, to withstand a plane crash. There are 520 airlock doors at the facility and four levels of security. It's where you'd want to be in the zombie apocalypse, a staff member told me. Until recently, the center was known as the Australian Animal Health Laboratory, and at the highest biosecurity level, BSL-4, there are vials of some of the nastiest animal-borne pathogens on the planet, including Ebola. The laboratory gets a shout-out in the movie Contagion. Staff members who work in BSL-4 units can't wear their own clothes into the lab and have to shower for at least 3 minutes before heading home. The animals at the facility, for their part, can't leave at all. Their only way out is through the incinerator, is how one employee put it to me. About a year ago, not long before the pandemic began, I paid a visit to the center, which is an hour southwest of Melbourne. The draw was an experiment on a species of giant toad known familiarly as the cane toad. The toad was introduced to Australia as an agent of pest control, but it promptly got out of control itself, producing an ecological disaster. Researchers at the ACDP were hoping to put the toad back in the bottle, as it were, using CRISPR. A molecular biologist named Mark Tizard, who was in charge of the project, had agreed to show me around. Tizard is a slight man with a fringe of white hair and twinkling blue eyes. Like many of the scientists I met in Australia, he's from somewhere else. In his case, England. Before getting into amphibians, Tizard worked mostly on poultry. Several years ago, he and some colleagues at the center inserted a jellyfish gene into a hen. This gene, similar to the one I was planning to plug into my yeast, encodes a fluorescent protein. A chicken in possession of it will, as a consequence, emit an eerie glow under UV light. Next, Tizard figured out a way to insert the fluorescence gene so that it would be passed down to male offspring only. The result is a hen whose chicks can be sexed while they're still in their shells. Tizard knows that many people are freaked out by genetically modified organisms. They find the idea of eating them repugnant and of releasing them into the world anathema. Though he is no provocateur, he, like Zahner, believes that such people are looking at things all wrong. "We have chickens that glow green," Tizard told me. "Wow. And so we have school groups that come, and when they see the green chicken, you know, some of the kids go, 'Oh, that's really cool. Hey, if I eat that chicken, will I turn green?' And I'm like, 'You eat chicken already, right? Have you grown feathers and a beak?'" Anyway. According to Tizard, it's too late to be worried about a few genes here and there. If you look at a native Australian environment, you see eucalyptus trees, koalas, kookaburras, whatever, he said. "If I look at it as a scientist, what I'm seeing is multiple copies of the eucalyptus genome, multiple copies of the koala genome, and so on. And these genomes are interacting with each other. Then, all of a sudden, plumph, you put an additional genome in there, the cane toad genome. It was never there before, and its interaction with all these other genomes is catastrophic. It takes other genomes out completely." He went on, "What people are not seeing is that this is already a genetically modified environment. Invasive species alter the environment by adding entire creatures that don't belong. Genetic engineers, by contrast, just alter a few stretches of DNA here and there. What we're doing is potentially adding maybe 10 more genes onto the 20,000 toad genes that shouldn't be there in the first place, and those 10 will sabotage the rest and take them out of the system and so restore balance," Tizard said. The classic thing people say with molecular biology is, "Are you playing God?" Well, no. We are using our understanding of biological processes to see if we can benefit a system that is in trauma. Formerly known as Rhinella marina, cane toads are a splotchy brown with thick limbs and bumpy skin. Descriptions inevitably emphasize their size. Rhinella marina is an enormous, warty bufonid, true toad, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service notes. The U.S. Geological Survey observes that large individuals sitting on roadways are easily mistaken for boulders. The biggest cane toad ever recorded was 15 inches long and weighed 6 pounds, as much as a chubby chihuahua. A toad named Big Bet, who lived at the Queensland Museum in Brisbane in the 1980s, was 9.5 inches long and almost as wide, about the size of a dinner plate. The toads will eat almost anything they can fit in their oversized mouths, including mice, dog food, and other cane toads. Cane toads are native to South America, Central America, and the southernmost tip of Texas. In the mid-1800s, they were brought to the Caribbean. The idea was to enlist the toads in the battle against beetle grubs, which were plaguing the region's cash crop, sugarcane. Sugarcane, too, is an import. It is native to New Guinea. From the Caribbean, the toads were shipped to Hawaii. In 1935, 102 toads were loaded onto a steamer in Honolulu, headed for Australia. 101 survived the journey and ended up at a research station in sugarcane country in northeast Queensland. Within a year, they'd produced more than 1.5 million eggs. A female cane toad can produce up to 30,000 eggs at a go. The resulting toadlets were intentionally released into the region's rivers and ponds. It's doubtful that the toads ever did the sugarcane much good. Cane beetles perch too high off the ground for a boulder-sized amphibian to reach. This didn't faze the toads. They found plenty else to eat and continued to produce toadlets by the truckload. From a sliver of the Queensland coast, they pushed north into the Cape York Peninsula and south into New South Wales. Sometime in the 1980s, they crossed into the Northern Territory. In 2005, they reached a spot known as Middle Point in the western part of the territory, not far from the city of Darwin. Along the way, something curious happened. In the early phase of the invasion, the toads were advancing at the rate of about 6 miles a year. A few decades later, they were moving at the pace of 12 miles a year. By the time they hit Middle Point, they'd sped up to 30 miles a year. When researchers measured the individuals at the invasion front, they found out why. The toads had significantly longer legs than the toads back in Queensland, and this trait was heritable. The Northern Territory News played the story on its front page under the headline Super Toad. Accompanying the article was a doctored photo of a cane toad wearing a cape. It has invaded the territory, and now the hated cane toad is evolving, the newspaper gasped. Contra Darwin, it seemed, evolution could be observed in real time. Cane toads are not just disturbingly large. From a human perspective, they're also ugly, with bony heads and what looks like a leering expression. The trait that makes them truly hated, though, is that they're toxic. When an adult is bitten or feels threatened, it releases a milky goo that swims with heart-stopping compounds. Dogs often suffer cane toad poisoning, the symptoms of which range from frothing at the mouth to cardiac arrest. People who are foolish enough to consume cane toads risk winding up dead. Australia has no poisonous toads of its own. Indeed, it has no native toads at all, so its fauna hasn't evolved to be wary of them. The cane toad story is thus the Asian carp story inside out, or maybe upside down. Invasive Asian carp are wreaking havoc in America because nothing eats them. Cane toads are a menace in Australia because just about everything eats them. The list of species whose numbers have crashed due to cane toad consumption is long and varied. It includes freshwater crocodiles, which Australians call freshies, yellow-spotted monitor lizards, which can grow more than 5 feet long, northern blue-tongued lizards, which are actually skinks, Australian water dragons, which look like small dinosaurs, common death adders, which, as the name suggests, are venomous snakes, and king brown snakes, which are also venomous. By far, the most winning animal on the victims list is the northern quoll, a sweet-looking marsupial. Northern quolls are about a foot long, with pointy faces and spotted brown coats. When young quolls graduate from their mother's pouch, she carries them on her back. In an effort to slow down the cane toads, Australians have come up with all sorts of ingenious and not-so-ingenious schemes. The Toadinator is a trap fitted out with a portable speaker that plays the cane toad's song, which some compare to a dial tone and others to the thrum of a motor. Researchers at the University of Queensland have developed a bait that can be used to lure cane toad tadpoles to their doom. People shoot the toads with air rifles, whack them with hammers, bash them with golf clubs, purposely run them over with their cars, stick them in the freezer until they solidify, and spray them with a compound called HopStop, which, its manufacturer assures buyers, anesthetizes toads within seconds and dispatches them within an hour. Communities organize toad-busting militias. A group called the Kimberley Toadbusters has recommended that the Australian government offer a bounty for each toad eliminated. The group's motto is, "If everyone was a toadbuster, the toads would be busted." At the point that Tizard got interested in cane toads, he'd never actually seen one. Geelong lies in southern Victoria, a region that the toads haven't yet conquered. But one day, at a meeting, he was seated next to a molecular biologist who studied the amphibian. She told him that despite all the busting, the toads kept on spreading. She said it was such a shame if only there was some new way of getting at it, Tizard recalled. "Well, I sat down and scratched my head." He went on, "I thought toxins are generated by metabolic pathways. That means enzymes, and enzymes have to have genes to encode them. Well, we have tools that can break genes. Maybe we can break the gene that leads to the toxin." As luck would have it, a team at the University of Queensland, led by a chemist named Rob Capon, had recently isolated a crucial enzyme behind the toxin. Tizard brought on a postdoc, Caitlin Cooper, to help with the mechanics. Cooper has shoulder-length brown hair and an infectious laugh. She, too, is from somewhere else. In her case, Massachusetts. No one had ever tried to gene-edit a cane toad before, so it was up to Cooper to figure out how to do it. Cane toad eggs, she discovered, had to be washed and then pierced just so with a very fine pipette, and this needed to be done quickly before they had time to start dividing. Refining the micro-injection technique took quite a while, she told me. As a sort of warm-up exercise, Cooper set out to change the cane toad's color. A key pigment gene for toads, and for that matter mammals, codes for the enzyme tyrosinase, which controls the production of melanin. Cooper reasoned that disabling this pigment gene should produce toads that were light-colored instead of dark. She mixed some eggs and sperm in a petri dish, micro-injected the resulting embryos with various CRISPR-related compounds, and waited. Three oddly modeled tadpoles emerged. One of the tadpoles died. The other two, both male, grew into mottled toadlets. They were christened Spot and Blondie. "I was absolutely rapt when this happened," Tizard told me. Cooper next turned her attention to breaking the toad's toxicity. Cane toads store their poison in glands behind their shoulders. In its raw form, the poison is merely sickening, but when attacked, toads can produce the enzyme that Capon isolated, bufotoxin hydrolase, which amplifies the venom's potency 100-fold. Using CRISPR, Cooper edited a second batch of embryos to delete a section of the gene that codes for bufotoxin hydrolase. The result was a batch of less toxic toadlets. After we'd talked for a while, Cooper offered to show me her toads. This entailed penetrating deeper into the ACDP, through more airlock doors and layers of security. We all put scrubs on over our clothes and booties over our shoes. Cooper spritzed my tape recorder with some kind of cleaning fluid. "Quarantine area," a sign said. "Heavy penalties apply." I decided it would be better not to mention the Odin and my own rather less secure gene editing adventures. Beyond the doors was a sort of antiseptic barnyard filled with animals in variously sized enclosures. The smell was a cross between a hospital and a petting zoo. Near a block of mouse cages, the detoxed toadlets were hopping around a plastic tank. There were a dozen of them, about 10 weeks old and each about 3 inches long. "They're very lively, as you can see," Cooper said. The tank had been outfitted with everything a person could imagine a toad would want. Fake plants, a tub of water, a sun lamp. I thought of Toad Hall, replete with every modern convenience. One of the toads stuck out its tongue and nabbed a cricket. "They will eat literally anything," Tizard said. "They'll eat each other. If a big one encounters a small one, it's lunch." Let loose in the Australian countryside, a knot of detoxed toads presumably wouldn't last long. Some would become lunch for either freshies or lizards or death adders, and the rest would be outbred by the hundreds of millions of toxic toads already hopping across the landscape. What Tizard had in mind for them was a career in education. Research on quolls suggests that the marsupials can be trained to steer clear of cane toads. Feed them toad legs laced with an emetic, and they will associate toads with nausea and learn to avoid them. Detoxed toads, according to Tizard, would make an even better training tool. If they're eaten by a predator, the predator will get sick but not die, and it will go, "I'm never eating a toad again." Before they could be used for teaching quolls or for any other purpose, the detoxed toads would need a variety of government permits. When I visited, Cooper and Tizard hadn't started in on the paperwork, but they were already contemplating other ways to tinker. Cooper thought it might be possible to fiddle with one of the genes that produce the gel coat on the toad's eggs, and to do so in such a way that the eggs couldn't be fertilized. When she described the idea to me, I was like, "Brilliant," Tizard said. "If we can take steps to knock down their fecundity, that's absolute gold." A few feet away from the detoxed toads, Spot and Blondie were sitting in their own tank, an even more elaborate affair, with a picture of a tropical scene propped in front for their enjoyment. They were almost a year old and fully grown, with thick rolls of flesh around their midsections, like sumo wrestlers. Spot was mostly brown, with one yellowish hind leg. Blondie was more richly variegated, with whitish hind legs and light patches on his forelimbs and chest. Cooper reached a gloved hand into the tank and pulled out Blondie, whom she'd described to me as beautiful. He immediately peed on her. He appeared to be smiling malevolently. He had, it seemed to me, a face only a genetic engineer could love. According to the standard version of genetics that kids learn in school, inheritance is a roll of the dice. Let's say a person, or a toad, has received one version of a gene from his mother, call it A, and a rival version of this gene, A1, from his father. Then any child of his will have even odds of inheriting an A or an A1, and so on. With each new generation, A and A1 will be passed down according to the laws of probability. Like much else that's taught in school, this account is only partly true. There are genes that play by the rules, and there are renegades that don't. Outlaw genes fix the game in their own favor, and do so in a variety of devious ways. Some interfere with the replication of a rival gene, others make extra copies of themselves to increase their odds of being passed down, and still others manipulate the process of meiosis, by which eggs and sperm are formed. Such rule-breaking genes are said to drive. Even if they confer no fitness advantage, indeed, even if they impose a fitness cost, they're passed on more than half of the time. Some particularly self-serving genes are passed on more than 90% of the time. Driving genes have been discovered lurking in a great many creatures, including mosquitoes, flower beetles, and lemmings, and it's believed that they could be found in a great many more if anyone took the trouble to look for them. The most successful driving genes are hard to detect because they've driven other variants to oblivion. Since the 1960s, it's been a dream of biologists to exploit the power of gene drives, to drive the drive, as it were. Thanks to CRISPR, this dream has now been realized, and then some. In bacteria, which might be said to hold the original patent on the technology, CRISPR functions as an immune system. Bacteria that possesses a CRISPR locus can incorporate snippets of DNA from viruses into their own genomes. They use these snippets. It's like mugshots to recognize potential assailants. Then they dispatch CRISPR-associated, or Cas, enzymes, which work like tiny knives. The enzymes slice the invader's DNA at critical locations, thus disabling them. Genetic engineers have adapted the CRISPR-Cas system to cut pretty much any DNA sequence they wish. They've also figured out how to induce a damaged sequence to stitch into itself a thread of foreign DNA it's been supplied with. This is how my E. coli were fooled into replacing an adenine with a cytosine. Since the CRISPR-Cas system is a biological construct, it too is encoded in DNA. This turns out to be key to creating a gene drive. Insert the CRISPR-Cas genes into an organism, and the organism can be programmed to perform the task of genetic reprogramming on itself. In 2015, a group of scientists at Harvard announced that they'd used this self-reflexive trick to create a synthetic gene drive in yeast. Starting with some cream-colored yeast and some red yeast, they produced colonies that, after a few generations, were all red. This was followed 3 months later by an announcement from researchers at the University of California, San Diego, that they'd used much the same trick to create a synthetic gene drive in fruit flies. Fruit flies are normally brown. The drive, pushing a gene for a kind of albinism, yielded offspring that were yellow. 7 months later, the San Diego researchers, along with some colleagues from the University of California, Irvine, announced that they had created a gene drive in Anopheles mosquitoes, which carry malaria. If CRISPR confers the power to rewrite the very molecules of life, a synthetic gene drive increases that power exponentially. Suppose the researchers in San Diego had released their yellow fruit flies. Assuming that those flies had found mates swarming around some campus dumpster, their offspring too would have been yellow. And assuming that those offspring survived and also successfully mated, their progeny would, in turn, have been yellow. The trait would have continued to spread, ineluctably, from the redwood forest to the Gulf Stream waters until yellow ruled. And there's nothing special about color in fruit flies. Just about any gene in any plant or animal can, in principle at least, be programmed to load the inheritance dice in its own favor. This includes genes that have themselves been modified or borrowed from other species. It should be possible, for example, to engineer a drive that would spread a broken toxin gene among cane toads. It may also be possible one day to create a drive for corals that would push a gene for heat tolerance to help them survive global warming. In a world of synthetic gene drives, the border between the human and the natural, between the laboratory and the wild, already deeply blurred, all but dissolves. In such a world, not only do people determine the conditions under which evolution is taking place, people can, again, in principle, determine the outcome. The first mammal to be fitted out with a CRISPR-assisted gene drive will almost certainly be a mouse. Mice are what's known as a model organism. They breed quickly, are easy to raise, and their genome has been intensively studied. Paul Thomas is a pioneer in mouse research. His lab is in Adelaide at the South Australian Health and Medical Research Institute, a sinuous building covered in pointy metal plates. Adelaideans refer to the building as the cheese grater. When I went to visit, I thought it looked more like an ankylosaurus. As soon as the first paper on CRISPR as a gene editing tool was published in 2012, Thomas recognized it as a game changer. "We jumped on it straight away," he told me. Within a year, his lab had used CRISPR to engineer a mouse afflicted with epilepsy. When the first papers on synthetic gene drives came out, Thomas once again plunged in. "Being interested in CRISPR and being interested in mouse genetics, I couldn't resist the opportunity to try to develop the technology," he said. Initially, his goal was just to see if he could get the technology to work. "We didn't really have much funding. We were doing it on the smell of an oily rag, and these experiments, they're quite expensive." While Thomas was still, in his words, just dabbling, he was contacted by a group that calls itself GBIRD. The acronym stands for Genetic Biocontrol of Invasive Rodents, and the group's ethos might be described as Dr. Moreau joins Friends of the Earth. "Like you, we want to preserve our world for generations to come," GBIRD's website says. "There is hope." The site features a picture of an albatross chick gazing lovingly at its mother. G-Bird wanted Thomas's help designing a very particular kind of mouse gene drive, a so-called suppression drive, intended to defeat natural selection entirely. Its purpose is to spread a trait so deleterious that it can wipe out a population. Researchers in Britain have already engineered a suppression drive for Anopheles gambii mosquitoes. Their goal is to eventually release the modified mosquitoes in Africa. Thomas told me that there were various ways to go about designing a self-suppressing mouse, most having to do with sex. He was particularly keen on the idea of an X-shredder mouse. Mice, like other mammals, have two sex-determining chromosomes. XXs are females, XYs male. Sperm carry a single chromosome, either an X or a Y. An X-shredder mouse is a mouse who has been gene-edited so that all of his X-bearing sperm are defective. Half the sperm drop out of the sperm pool, if you like, Thomas explained. They can't develop anymore. That leaves you with just Y-bearing sperm, so you get all male progeny. Put the shredding instructions on the Y chromosome, and the mouse's offspring will, in turn, produce only sons, and so on. With each generation, the sex imbalance will grow until there are no females left to reproduce. Thomas said that work on a gene drive mouse was going more slowly than he'd hoped. Still, he thought that by the end of the decade, someone would develop one. It might be an X shredder, or it might use a design scheme that's yet to be imagined. Mathematical modeling suggests that an effective suppression drive would be extremely efficient. 100 gene drive mice released on an island could take a population of 50,000 ordinary mice down to zero within a few years. So that's quite striking, Thomas said. That's the best case scenario. It's something to aim for. It's often said that we live in the Anthropocene, a new geological epoch defined by human impacts on the planet. One of the features of this new epoch is a redistribution of the world's rodents. Everywhere that people have settled, and even some places they've only visited, mice and rats have tagged along, often with ugly consequences. The Pacific rat, Rattus excellens, was once confined to Southeast Asia. Starting about 3,000 years ago, seafaring Polynesians carried it to nearly every island in the Pacific. Its arrival set off wave after wave of destruction that claimed an estimated 1,000 species of birds. Later, European colonists brought to those islands, and many others, ship rats, Rattus rattus, setting off further waves of extinctions that are still ongoing. In the case of New Zealand's Big South Cape Island, ship rats arrived in the 1960s, by which point naturalists were on hand to watch the carnage. Despite intensive efforts to save them, three species endemic to the island, one bat and two birds, disappeared. The house mouse, Mus musculus, originated on the Indian subcontinent. It can now be found from the tropics to very near the poles. According to Lee Silver, the author of Mouse Genetics, only humans are as adaptable. Some would say less so. Under the right circumstances, mice can be just as fierce as rats, and every bit as deadly. Gough Island, which lies more or less midway between Africa and South America, is home to the world's last 2,000 breeding pairs of Tristan albatross. Video cameras installed on the island have recorded gangs of musculus attacking albatross chicks and eating them alive. Working on Gough Island is like working in an ornithological trauma center, Alex Bond, a Canadian conservation biologist, has written. For the past few decades, the weapon of choice against invasive rodents has been Brodificum, an anticoagulant that induces terminal hemorrhaging. Brodificum can be incorporated into bait and then dispensed from feeders, or it can be spread by hand, or dropped from the air. First, you ship a species around the world, then you poison it from helicopters. Hundreds of uninhabited islands have been de-moused and de-ratted in this way, and such campaigns have helped bring scores of species back from the edge, including New Zealand's Campbell Island teal, a small flightless duck, and the Antiguan racer, a grayish lizard-eating snake. The downside of Brodificum, from a rodent's perspective, is pretty obvious. Internal bleeding is a slow and painful way to go. From an ecologist's perspective, too, there are drawbacks. Non-target animals often take the bait or eat rodents that have eaten it. In this way, poison spreads up and down the food chain. And if just one pregnant mouse survives an application, she can readily repopulate an island. Gene-driven mice would scuttle around these problems. Impacts would be targeted. There would be no more bleeding to death. And perhaps best of all, gene-drive rodents could be released on inhabited islands, where dropping anticoagulants from the air is, understandably, frowned upon. But as is so often the case, solving one set of problems introduces new ones. In this case, big ones, humongous ones. Gene-drive technology has been compared to Kurt Vonnegut's Ice Nine, a single shard of which is enough to freeze all the water in the world. A single X-Shredder mouse on the loose could, it's feared, have a similarly chilling effect. A sort of Mice Nine. To guard against a Vonnegutian catastrophe, various fail-safe schemes have been proposed, with names like Killer Rescue, Multi-Locus Assortment, and Daisy Chain. All of them share a basic, hopeful premise. It should be possible to engineer a gene drive that's effective, but not too effective. Such a drive might be engineered so as to exhaust itself after a few generations, or it might be yoked to a gene variant that's limited to a single population on a single island. It has also been suggested that if a gene drive did somehow manage to go rogue, it might be possible to send out into the world another gene drive, featuring a Cas9-triggered chain ablation, or CACHA sequence, to chase it down. What could possibly go wrong?
Jesus.
While I was in Australia, I wanted to get out of the lab and into the countryside. I thought it would be fun to see some northern quolls. In the photos I'd found online, they looked awfully cute, a bit like miniature badgers. But when I asked around, I learned that quoll spotting required a lot more expertise and time than I had. It would be much easier to find some of the amphibians that were killing them. So one evening, I set out with a biologist named Lynn Schwarzkopf to go toad hunting. Schwarzkopf, who is from Canada, was one of the inventors of the Toadinator trap. And the first thing we did was stop by her office at James Cook University so that I could take a look at the device. It was a cage about the size of a toaster oven with a plastic flap door. When Schwarzkopf turned on the trap's little speaker, the office reverberated with the toad's thrumming call. Male toads are attracted to anything that sounds even remotely like a cane toad, she told me. If they hear a generator, they'll go to it. James Cook University is in northern Queensland, the region where the toads were first introduced. Schwarzkopf figured we should be able to locate some toads right on the university grounds. We strapped on headlamps and went outside. It was about 9 p.m. and the place was deserted, except for the two of us and a family of wallabies hopping nearby. We wandered around for a while, looking for the glint of a malevolent eye. Just as I was beginning to lose heart, Schwarzkopf spotted a toad in the leaf litter. Picking it up, she immediately identified it as female. They won't hurt you unless you give them a really hard time, she said, pointing out the toad's venom glands, which looked like two baggy pouches. That's why you shouldn't hit them with a golf club, because if you hit the glands, the poison can spray out, and if it gets in your eyes, it will blind you for a few days. We wandered around some more. It had been very dry, Schwarzkopf observed, and the toads were probably short on moisture. They love air conditioning units, anything that's dripping. Near an old greenhouse, where someone had recently run a hose, we found two more toads. Schwarzkopf flipped over a rotting crate the size and shape of a coffin. The mother load, she announced. In about a quarter inch of scrummy water were more cane toads than I could count. Some were sitting on top of one another. I thought they might try to get away. Instead, they just sat there, unperturbed. The strongest argument for gene-editing cane toads, house mice, and ship rats is also the simplest. What's the alternative? The choice at this point is not between what was and what is, but between what is and what will be, which, often enough, is nothing. This is the situation of the Northern Quolls, the Campbell Island Teal, the Antiguan Racer, and the Tristan Albatross. Stick to a strict interpretation of the natural, and these, along with thousands of other species, are goners. Rejecting gene editing as unnatural isn't, at this point, going to bring nature back. We are as gods and might as well get good at it, Stuart Brand, the editor of the Whole Earth Catalog, wrote in its mission statement in 1969. Recently, in response to the whole Earth transformation that's underway, Brand has sharpened his statement. We are as gods and have to get good at it. Brand has co-founded a group, Revive and Restore, whose stated mission is to enhance biodiversity through new techniques of genetic rescue. Among the more fantastic projects the group has backed is an effort to resurrect the passenger pigeon. The idea is to reverse history by rejiggering the genes of the bird's closest living relative, the band-tailed pigeon. Much closer to realization is an effort to bring back the American chestnut tree. The tree, once common in the eastern U.S., was all but wiped out by chestnut blight. The blight, a fungal pathogen introduced to North America around 1900, killed off nearly every chestnut on the continent, an estimated 4 billion trees. Researchers at the SUNY College of Environmental Science and Forestry in Syracuse, New York, have created a genetically modified chestnut that's immune to blight. The key to its resistance is a gene imported from wheat. Owing to this single borrowed gene, the tree is considered transgenic and cannot be released into the world without federal permits. As a consequence, the blight-resistant saplings are, for now, confined to greenhouses and fenced-in plots. As Tizard points out, we're constantly moving genes around the world, usually in the form of entire genomes. This is how chestnut blight arrived in North America in the first place. It was carried in on Asian chestnut trees imported from Japan. If we can correct for our earlier tragic mistake by shifting just one more gene around, don't we owe it to the American chestnut to do so? The ability to rewrite the very molecules of life places us, it could be argued, under an obligation. Of course, the argument against such intervention is also compelling. The reasoning behind genetic rescue is the sort responsible for many a world-altering screw-up. See, for example, cane toads. The history of biological interventions designed to correct for previous biological interventions reads like Dr. Seuss's The Cat in the Hat Comes Back. The cat, after eating cake in the bathtub, is asked to clean up after himself. Do you know what he did? With mother's white dress? Now the tub was all clean, but her dress was a mess. In the 1950s, Hawaii's Department of Agriculture decided to control giant African snails, which had been introduced 2 decades earlier as garden ornaments, by importing rosy wolf snails, which are also known as cannibal snails. The cannibal snails mostly left the giant snails alone. Instead, they ate their way through dozens of species of Hawaii's small endemic land snails, producing what E.O. Wilson has called an extinction avalanche. Responding to Brand, Wilson has observed, "We are not as gods. We're not yet sentient or intelligent enough to be much of anything." Paul Kingsnorth, a British writer and activist, has put it this way, "We are as gods, but we have failed to get good at it. We are Loki, killing the beautiful for fun. We are Saturn, devouring our children." Kingsnorth has also observed, "Sometimes doing nothing is better than doing something. Right. Sometimes it is the other way around."
If you enjoyed this production,
and I was just saying, "God, I do not fear death, but I need you to help me because I'm alone. I cannot trust anyone. The doctors here is like, no, I don't say all, but I don't know anyone. So in my vision, Psalm 16:11 came to me. By the way, I'm ex-Muslim, but doesn't matter. I mean, I'm just not talking about the religions now, but I'm just a believer, strong believer. Good Lord saves me. I believe that because I am baptized by Holy Spirit. So what happened? After I prayed, it came to me, do the water fasting. Okay, and prayer. By the way, I'm taking all the supplements. I'm taking zinc, I'm taking NAC, I'm taking vitamin D. I'm every day exercising, even sometimes when I'm listening to your channel. By the way, thank you so much for your channel. I appreciate that, for the knowledge, all the things that you guys are sharing. I learn. And even sometimes while I'm jogging in our yard, I actually like listening to you guys. So what happened is like God told me fast, and I fast for almost 5 days, and lots of things actually was gone from my body. Then I started to detoxing by Epsom salt and essential oils that you guys a few days ago talk about that. And I was like literally wanted to intervene and say, yes, I'm doing all these things, not just now. It's like 5-6 years I'm dealing with all essential oils and these things. I'm not a medication or medicine person. So what happened? The fear. He said, come to me and I will show you the way. I came to him and I asked him and he's showing me. I know the healing is there, but it's slow. I want to say, if you're fear, you are a child of God. He will take care of you. But you have to pray for the spirit of wisdom. We all have to ask his guidance. They asked me to do the supposed called booster shot for the second time and third time. I said, I declined. I said, every time I said, I'm not well. Nobody even asked me why you're not well, because they don't care. Mm-hmm. So what I'm saying, just attach your soul to him as much as you can. He will show you the way. He will show you how to get rid of partially some parts of it, this toxin, which is your body. And back to your topic, 5 million deaths. I don't know even this is the exact number, because back to my own country, original country, Iran, yes, doctors who are the whistleblowers, they say, whatever they announce, multiply that to 10. So I'm not going to say there is no COVID. There is COVID. My parents got COVID 4 months ago. But because their immunity system were good, they were taking all the supplements that I was suggesting them to take. They actually recovered without any of these remdesivir, what they call. Sorry if my spellings, I mean, pronunciation is wrong, but none of them. So after they got back home, my mom was having a bit of chest pain, and I actually, my mom is Muslim. So I told her, just put your hand on your chest. I'm going to pray for you in the name of Jesus. So the next day she said, you know what? The pain is all gone. So I believe in healing, but I do believe that there are things that we have to do to make sure that our body is reacting to them. But our body tells us what we have to do. My body told me, just go barefoot, walk or jog on the grass and the yard. I felt that energy to connect to the earth because God created everything. So he has the control over everything. Doesn't matter how much evil is in power now. Doesn't matter because he's in control. I land my plane. Thank you for listening to me.
Hey, this is LJ. Can I speak? Can you guys hear me? I have my headphones on. I don't know if you can hear me well.
Yes, we can hear you, Queen. Go ahead.
Okay, I just want to ask a question to anybody that can answer, and then I'll give you my opinion based on the question. Has this virus actually been proven to be passed from person to person?
Yes, Gloria, can I have a second, please? Can I have a second, please? Hold on a second. For the previous speaker, that's awesome. Thank you so much. Thank you for your share. I'm glad for you that you are doing well and you're sharing everything that you did. And that's a confirmation from the Lord that he is with us.
Yeah, this is Bleed. That it always feels good when I hear Iranian or Iraqi women be able to go ahead and speak highly. That is so awesome. God bless you.
Absolutely. God bless you, sister. And make sure and become a member, okay, honey?
Thank you, I am. And thank you, everyone. God bless everyone. We belong to one nation. There is no Iranian, there is no, I mean, of course, we respect each other, but we are all one nation. Let's not forget that. So I'm not talking about like world order and the order and these things. No, I'm not. I don't mean that way. But I mean, in faith, we are all same and we believe in one same God. So to me, he's speaking to us. Evil is very bold. The game is very bold. You see that this is not planned now. It planned long time ago, but we already. Actually, this is a very good thing because now we are digging more and more and more. We are educating ourselves, no matter how much they censor everything. I grew up with censorship. I grew up with these totalitarian thoughts. So by looking at the world now, I say, oh, man, I never thought that that mentality that I experienced for 40 years in my life is going to be in the international level. I wouldn't see that in a million years, but I can see now. And I would say like, man, you are evil. But God is in control because it's proving all the time, no matter how much you censor control. Here we are in this group. Here we are in other platforms that whistleblowers are talking. Thank you, everybody.
Amen, sister.
I like
make you sure and become a member, okay? Thank you, honey. God bless you. We love you. We love to have having you and everyone else as well. Okay, honey. Thank you.
I'd like to make a comment to Karam.
Yes, ma'am. Go ahead.
And I agree with you with what you said. I used to be a Christian. I'm not any longer. I'm into another type of religion. And what I'd like to say is that whatever people's religion or faith or belief is, I think when we all go to whoever we worship and pray or meditate or whatever a person do, that helps the situation as a group because we're all one-minded in what we want for our entire universe is to get these evil people out of power, stop these shots and whatever else is going on. I know for myself, I got a illegal shot when I was in the military. So I always had a wall up and an untrust. And I just didn't jump into anything based on somebody telling me what to do right now.
Almost, I was listening to somebody talking about this book the other day, and it's almost like those people who are in denial, you almost need to strike their curiosity. Like bringing something up that's, you know, have you heard of Fauci and the history? Like almost not mentioning that he's done anything wrong, but to like tell the whole story. Like if you really want to know the whole story, this is the book. But not mentioning that it necessarily exposes all the atrocities he had committed. And like, and I told the people that I had given it, I said, please go to chapter 7, because to me, chapter 7 speaks about the experiments they've done on orphans and foster children in New York at this lab out there.
Yes.
And I was in tears when they talked about, when the book talks about children having surgically inserted plastic tubes because they were refusing to take those meds that they were feeding them with. And they knew that they would get ill from it. So they put tubes down their throats and they would force feed them those meds.
Oh my God. I don't remember that
this
part.
Is, who does this? I just couldn't. I remember I just burst into tears.
Called in one of the doctors. He saw it. He was in shock too. Called one of our lab guys, one of our favorite lab guys. He couldn't even identify what kind it was, what kind of parasites they were. So all of us that did this, all of us are not working because there's no way in hell I'm going to put that up my nose.
How you know period. A parasite? How you know?
They're live microorganisms.
What did it look like? What looked like?
Who's talking? So I know who I'm speaking with?
It looked like Gene.
It looked like Gene at the bottom. Gene was saying whatever that was.
Oh, I already know what's going on. I looked at the profile, so I'm going to ignore it. It looked like a head with multiple legs, and it's called Polypodium hydriform. Is that a direct enough answer? I gave you the name of it.
Pelagia, she's got broken English. I've been speaking to her on the back. Okay. So it might sound like she's asking, but she's not.
I'm looking at them on the followers, so I'm going by something.
No, else. I've not been speaking on the back because she's been trying to, you know.
Jean, what language do you speak, Jean? Jean, what language do you speak, please?
It's something shaking out.
He's a troll because I speak a lot of languages because I was ready to go. I already know it was a troll. So let's go back to business. Forget her. So it's called Polypodium hydriform. So I'm not putting that up my nose. I'm not working anymore. I lost my 401k, my pension. I have no unemployment.
Can I ask you something?
Is that Hydra vulgaris you're talking about, or is that
no, different?
Just know that Jean is still down in the room for those that care about that.
Did she take herself down?
I don't know if she did or not.
Bernard, do you know what language she speaks?
Let's see what she says.
If she's able to ask a question in English, she could answer what language she speaks.
I sent her an invite. Come on up, Jean.
I don't play games.
It's something in that test, because I took about 5 of them because the VA wouldn't let me see the dentist without taking that test.
Well, I have more information for you, Miss Arlene.
She's been telling me about deuterium water.
I'm asking it's a very simple question. What language does she speak?
No, I'm just...
What I'm saying is, if you got ill intentions, you're not going to reveal yourself.
Exactly.
That's one thing I know about life. You know, when you get pushed to the, let's call it to the mat, and all of a sudden you get quiet.
She's not answering a simple question.
If it was my room, that person wouldn't be in the room anymore, just because I don't even like him listening in.
That's, I know it's a troll. Let's get back to business, because this is about our lives. So I'm going to continue, if that's okay. So if you do 24 tests, that's the average amount, and the reason it's average because everybody's health is different. Every person is different, as we all know. That's just common sense. The nasal mucosa, which is the lining of the inside lining of your nose, starts getting damaged. That's why a lot of people, when they have their tests, some people on the first test this happens, they get headaches after a PCR test because of what's on the swab other than the parasites, the chemicals, and or get a bloody nose. It's a very common thing.
Bingo, that's absolutely common. Nosebleed.
Yes, so per Lou, I'm going over this because I respect Lou a lot and love her very much. The next thing, if common sense now, the word zombie in Hebrew, I look up words because I speak a lot of languages. I look it up in Hebrew and in the Greek. The word zombie, one of the nouns that's used in the definition is the word stupid. If you look at the word stupid, it says somebody that lacks common intelligence or common sense. So people have lost, most people, not everybody, has lost their common sense. And we've seen it on our daily, not on Clubhouse, I'm talking about real life. So think about this logically before I go to the next subject. If a PCR test, this is a fact, has chemicals and parasites on the swabs. And I've seen it with my own eyes. My ex-coworker saw it with me, and we all declined to do it, so we lost our jobs. I have, again, no EDD, no pension. I was pensioned. It would have been 20 years next month. I went to school, top of my class. I still said no. And I love people. I went into medicine for the right reason. I help people to get better naturally more than anything. So if the PCR test has this garbage and poison on it and parasites, what makes you think, not you guys, but what makes people think, question the vaccine when the PCR test is tainted with this stuff? It's just common sense. People say, you don't know what's on the vaccine. If the PCR test has the crap on it, why wouldn't the vaccine have the crap in it? To me, my husband and I, we describe the vaccines as slow arsenic poisoning, period. Now, awakening.
Facebook, Instagram, TikTok. You can never speak about what we're speaking right now, or YouTube. We would be, the accounts would be shut down. We could only speak on this app. Yes, a lot of people are in Clubhouse, but the majority of people on Clubhouse are not speaking about what we're speaking of today. They're talking about other things. Most people are still asleep, still getting the booster, still saying I was forced for my job. I have to feed my kids. No, you made a choice. So now we've gone to let's take a PCR test and wear masks. We went to here are the vaccines. Take the two or the one Johnson so we could get back to normal. Then they said, oops, even the vaccinated can transmit the vaccine, this fake virus. Oops, now we have to do a booster. Oops, it was 1 year, down to 6 months. In the UK, they're changing it to every 3 months. People are still going to take it. Oops. So now people next year are going to start getting sick. But those, there's no way I hear about pine needle tea. I hear about all this stuff to get it out of your system. You cannot take trackers out your system. As soon as they shoot it in your arm, it starts working ASAP. So for anybody that has done the vaccines that's in this room, I'm sorry if you're hearing this, but I only speak truths. So are people waking up? Okay, let's say somebody says, I'm not going to get the booster. I've had people in my family say they're not going to get the booster. And guess what? They got the booster, including my mother. She says, I'm not getting another one. She got the booster. So now, oops, for international flights, even if you're vaccinated and an American and you want to come back to the United States because you went to Paris or something, guess what? Even the vaccinated have to do the PCR test now. Do you see where this is going? It's just step-by-step conditioning. So the only way we're going to win, and I'm going to go scriptural, is when Christ comes back. Until then, it's going to be battles. We're going to win the war at the end when Christ comes back. And for those that don't believe, I encourage you to give your life to Christ, because that's the only way. You're either with a no degree, okay?
Right.
He lied that he didn't know Epstein. Then there's proof with pictures with his arm around him, and he says, oh, I don't remember. And this person is in charge of all this.
They hung out.
They hung out since their 20s. Wait, let me finish, and I'll land my plane. We're not discussing religion, but we're talking about he's demonic. Demonic is part of what the Bible talks about.
We agree on that.
Okay, so he's demonic. He's not going to be stopped until Christ comes back. Then he's talking about other stuff. There's a nurse that told me that in Philadelphia, there were two smallpox cases in a hospital in Philadelphia. And nowhere on the news does it talk about that. February, I keep on, and Lou has heard me for months. February is going to be the beginning of the real stuff that's going to be happening. The real poop show. I'm trying not to cuss. The real poop show is going to start in February, less than 2 months away. So we have not one. There might be some people here and there that might not take the booster. They're going to be so sick.
Yeah, but Malaji, I'm going to tell you something. Just the fact, I don't care if it's 10% of the people. If 10% of people are awake and see what they're doing.
It's not 10%,
though. There's no way you can stop that. There's no way you can stop that. It's a snowball effect. People are awakening every day. They're starting.